Hey, everybody, this is Sonny. I just want to give you a heads up that this episode with Kevin Getz about his new book, How to Score in Hollywood, Secrets to Success in the Movie Business, went out last week on the over at the Substack at thebulwark.com. It did not go out over the proper Apple feeds for reasons of me being in Paris and not scheduling it correctly. But that means you're going to get two episodes this week. You're going to get this one and today on Monday, and then you're going to get another episode on Friday. But again, this episode is already out. So if you subscribe to the Substack, you should. You should go to thebulwark.com and subscribe. You will have already heard this episode. But if you don't, if you haven't, it's a really good one. Kevin is one of the most interesting people in Hollywood. His work at Screen Engine ASI is really important, and I'm a big fan of what he does and his books. We had him on to talk Audienceology a couple years back. That was great. This book is also really great. Again, How to Score in Hollywood, Secrets to Success in the Movie Business. You gotta check it out. He is doing interesting things. He will help you understand the movie business like nobody else. Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'm very pleased to be rejoined today by Kevin Getz. I've had him on the show before. He is the guru of audience testing. He's the guy you want to talk to. We've had him on to talk about his book, Audienceology, which was great. We've had him on to talk about his podcast, Don't Kill the Messenger. I'm sure we're going to get more on that here. It's if you want an insight into the world of filmmaking, one of the number one podcasts you can listen to. And he had co-authored a book with Bob Levin that came out end of last year. And I've been trying to figure out how to get you on here for months now. But we've got you here. It's How to Score in Hollywood: Secrets to Success in the Movie Business. It's kind of a follow up to Audienceology, but lots of new stuff and lots of discussion about how testing has changed, what audiences are looking for, what the studios want, what streamers want versus what studios want. I'm excited to have Kevin back on. Thank you for being on the show today.
It's my absolute pleasure. You know, I adore you, Sonny.
I'm going to skip to the end of the book. I'm going to skip to the end. We're going to do a flash forward to the end of the book here, because I want to touch on something that I think will be of interest to some of our folks who are, you know, have a toe in the political world as well as the film world. Here is a passage from your epilogue. I'm going to just quote here real quick. When I constructed my mantra that every movie, if made and marketed for the right price, should make money, I knew that the single most important element to prove the validity of that statement was the foundation on which I built it, the voice of the audience. End quote here. And I want to highlight this because I feel like this is a thing that both people in the film industry, the film world, and people in the political world have trouble with sometimes. The world is not how you want it to be. The world is how it is. The voters are not necessarily what you want them to be. The voters are what they are. The audience is not necessarily what you want it to be. The audience is what it is. How do you market yourself? How do you market your films? How do you reach that audience without undermining what you have set out to do? I think is the key thing here that everybody struggles with all the time. How do you do that?
Well, it's an excellent observation, Sonny, and it's really very true. We would like the world, you know, to come on board with whatever we're doing. I mean, that'd be the most ideal scenario. But in fact, there may be things, let's use movies, since that's what we're here to talk about, as the example. There may be a movie that you are passionate about as a filmmaker, but the world isn't, that you may be passionate about, that maybe only a tenth of who you think are going to be advocates for it are advocates for it. And so understanding that at the get-go, at the forefront, at the onset, is very, very valuable. Because if you can sort of size your audience at the earliest stages, you can make the movie for the quote-unquote right price. And the right price is really a measurement, an assessment of how many people are going to be intensely interested in this to the extent that they're going to either leave their homes, tune into it on a streamer, talk to their friends about it. Now, of course, you don't know how good it is yet, but that's okay. At this stage, all you need to know is, are people buying into the idea of it? You know, is it a sexy idea? Is it an elevated idea? And that, to me, is gold at the earliest stages.
Well, let's talk about this a little bit, because one of the big kind of innovations that you have worked on over the years is finding that audience, having studios come to you with an idea for a thing and going out to audiences and saying, right, well, are you interested in this? Can you talk about this? Because I've not really had a lot of experience here. It's really fascinating to kind of get this kind of pre-testing. You know, I think everybody understands the idea of going to a test screening and filling out the cards and talking about it. But this kind of idea of, well, should it be made in the first place? I think is a little bit I was not as familiar with it.
Okay, so let me just first say that yes, it should be made in the first place. Yes, every movie should be made in the first place, but it should not necessarily be made for the money that you are thinking it should be made, to your opening comment, which is you may think that 80% of your audience is going to embrace this, and through research, we can say au contraire, only 20% of that audience is going to embrace it. Therefore, this movie can only be made if it's going to make money, and that is the ultimate goal, right? Is going to only make money if you are at, say, I'm making this number up, 16 million or under, right? Mm-hmm. If you make it for the 32 that you currently have it budgeted at, you're increasing your risk substantially. And that's the only thing this is trying to do. It's not trying to say, don't make the movie. It's just saying, make it for the right price. It's not a black and white exercise. It's not a foolproof exercise. It's one additional measurement, and maybe your most important measurement, of what you can do before you shoot a frame of film, just to assess how likely people will invest in this idea and get behind it, assuming, not even assuming it's going to be a great film, assuming it's going to be just an okay film. Of course, every filmmaker goes out saying, I'm going to make a great film, and they aspire to, and I've never heard anyone speak to the contrary of that. But the truth is, we have norms, averages, for a reason in the playability stage, once we actually have a movie. And I can tell you that more movies will get on a grade, a C, D, or an F, more than they'll ever get an A or a B. Mm-hmm. And you need a check mark to continue this logic into your playability. You got to have a movie, if you really want to be successful, that works and works really well. And that is the second part of where the book goes. The first part is understanding what you have before you shoot. The next part is making the best movie you can make. And the third part, of course, is marketing it. And then the last part is the social of it all, the social, the critics, all of that stuff, that through this process, which I call the four ability process, that's capability, playability, marketability, and buzzability. Through all of that, you can do check marks throughout to see and keep yourself honest. Now, you don't have to get check marks in everything, even to be successful, but you got to have at least one of them. So I say, certainly start at the first one, because the other three are far even less predictable than the first one. First one, you still have control over.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's run listeners through what that actually looks like. So when you hear from a studio, they say, we're thinking about this movie with this star. What's the very start of that process? And then how do you take it to potential viewers?
Okay. So let me back it up for a second and say, when we have a movie that's already completed, we recruit it, right, in the real world. We get people to show up at a movie theater. And we use what we call a recruit paragraph, which is about 1 to 2, maybe 300 words. That's all it is. And from that, we can tell you it took X number of invitations to get one person into the theater. It has the cast in it, the director, the producers, if they're marquee producers, or by so-and-so filmmaker comes, blah, blah, blah. And it's a way to get people interested to show up to your movie. From that, we can tell you that you are at a 10-to-1 recruit ratio. It took 10 invitations to get one body in the theater, which we call a moderate recruit. It might be a 16-to-1. 16 invitations to get one body in the theater. It could be a 30-to-1. Mm-hmm. It took 30 invitations. That is often a precursor, an early understanding of what kind of heavy lifting you're going to have to do with your marketing. And often it's very related to marketing. So if you understand that that's how this was born out of, is to pretend to do a recruit before you do a recruit, it makes intuitive sense. Mm-hmm. So for example, a studio will come to me now to answer your question and say, okay, we want to test these five concepts, these five movies we're contemplating. So I have them, not we don't do this, we ask them and have with help with their, from their filmmakers, usually, because a filmmaker could always say, well, that's not the movie I would make. So let's say they all agree on this concept with these elements. Often you don't have elements. You have to add them as you go along, because maybe 3 months after you've tested this, you've got a star now attached. So we don't even have that as much of an advantage early on. But you have your concept, you test it with an audience of, say, 1,000 people, and from that, you find out who's definitely interested in it, maybe probably interested, probably not interested, or definitely not interested. And from that, you can unpack various things. Why are you not interested? What is it? So we're also giving diagnostic information and help as to improve your concept to make it more sticky. And in this world, if it's a theatrical movie, you've got to be sticky. You've got to be elevated in your call to action that you're asking folks. The call to action being leaving your home to see a movie. Mm-hmm. That's a high order now. That's a big benchmark, right? It used to be a lot easier. And I'm talking even way before COVID hit. COVID only exacerbated even that further. So you want to measure those things. From that, you comp the movie to similar movies that tested in a similar way. And you can see how that box office behaved based on the same kind of numbers that you received on your movie.
Mm-hmm. What is, in your experience, what is the biggest factor for audiences? Is it the name of an actor that they recognize? Is it just the concept? Is it, you know, they recognize the source material? What's the big draw for audiences?
Right now, I'm finding something interesting happening. I find that it's not necessarily an actor, although a star could help. That is to say, if you tested the concept of Marty Supreme, I believe it would have tested, and I didn't do it, probably moderately well, maybe even poorly. Mm-hmm. The moment you add Timothy Chalamet to that, it elevates it in a way that almost demands a theatrical experience. That's a rare thing. If you are consistent with, let me say it this way. The concept has now taken even more import than ever before, along with the filmmaker executing it.
Mm-hmm.
So a Paul Thomas Anderson movie, even though the concept may be a little obtuse, a little bit not on the money, knowing his imprimatur is on that, knowing that, you know, Ryan Coogler's Sinners, it's almost like creates a different kind of import and gives it more gravitas. And that people are keen to now. It's quite interesting how that has seeped more into let's speak just about America for the moment, American culture. There are certain filmmakers that people want to see what's their next sort of creation. Jordan Peele, you know, different filmmakers that I can mention that have that same kind of really interesting vibe to them. Like people are interested in what they're going to turn out. And that speaks to the audiences wanting things that are fresh, maybe different, maybe unique than the same old sequel, let's say. Now, that also could have a great you know, need and want and desire to see. For example, the Super Mario Brothers second movie is hit tracking and it's going to be enormous. Mm-hmm. That's because the first one was so successful. And the next one is also going to be super successful. You can just feel the desire to see it now. So it can be a sequel. It can be a just a piece of IP that really is meaningful. It can be a star. But I find what your question, which I thought was an interesting one, is where do people seem to be heading now? And that seems to be more in the concept married with the filmmaker.
That's really interesting because years ago, back right before the pandemic, I talked to a guy who worked booking for a movie theater chain. And he said, look, the thing about audiences right now is if your name is not Christopher Nolan or Quentin Tarantino, they don't really care if you're directing it. And that does seem to have shifted pretty. The vibe shift seems to be real, right? Especially with guys like Ryan Coogler, Jordan Peele. I think Greta Gerwig might be on that list after Barbie. I do feel like there is greater awareness in the general movie going audience for specific filmmakers and what they bring to the table. Which does feel like a big shift over the last 10 years or so.
It is. It hasn't quite penetrated the mainstream. Let's not be hyperbolic about it, or precious about it. But yeah, I mean, South Korean films only 10 years ago would not have been accepted in this country. Let's look at that. You know, the stuff that Crunchyroll put out and the game related content that's coming out. It's very fascinating to me how there is more of, it's not penetrated, but more of the general public who are keen to this. Younger people, you know, are much more in touch with authenticity, and it doesn't have to be authenticity from America. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be authenticity from another country. A filmmaker, again, that has a unique and singular voice. Weapons, look at that. You know, that really was, the Softy Brothers, for example, is another, been just great. You know, and Weapons with Zach has been just extraordinary. Coming off his first picture and then this, and now he's going to be venturing into some other really cool territory with another
Resident Evil, right? Isn't he the Resident Evil?
Another big movie. I wasn't sure it was announced yet, but going to be, I think the potential is going to be enormous because it's, again, one might consider it as a continuation or a sequel, but to me, it's a reimagination. It's a reinvention. And that is to me, again, adds to this whole notion of elevation when it comes to how people leave their homes. That makes sense?
For sure. I mean, that is the trick, is getting people actually out there.
That's the theatrical world. But you know, the streamers are interesting because the streamers, of course, we work on many, if not most, of the movies that are produced by the streamers don't have a less clarion call for lesser content. In other words, consumers want to see they want to see great content anywhere. They don't want to see subpar content. Remember when we were growing up, Sonny, it'd be like, well, you could see that that's a home entertainment title. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that had a pejorative sense to it. I don't think that's the case anymore. It just means you can see it at home because of the convenience. You can see it at home because there are times when I just don't need to go out. And not because the movie was less than or is less than, but in fact, I should say, the streamers are very, very committed to want to increase their quality. You know, the streamer's design is not to appeal to everyone on every movie, which is why they often get criticized for their quality. There, you, Sonny, you're only supposed to like X number of the movies produced, not every one of them.
Yeah.
The studios are more sort of equated to the old network model, the old broadcast network model, where you had something that came out that was going to appeal to a large number of folks. And the streamers are more like the cables, where they are appealing to more of a specific person. You know, I Ann Sarnoff is going to be my guest on my podcast. And one of the things we talk about is the disruption of cable with the broadcast networks, and how specific audiences now were found and serviced. And I think that's very, very similar to what the streaming model is now. Theatrical is the one that I'm very hopeful about, the theatrical market, because I think as more people understand what I'm talking about with making things for the appropriate price, the model will bear out that there's great value in theatrical movie going from a business standpoint, because it does enter the zeitgeist in a different way, but it has to be done responsibly. That's all. And even though more people are going to the movies, in fact, they're seeing far fewer films. We have to understand what is it about those far fewer films and try to tap that alchemy. And I think that's how it would increase number of movies. Not just
Ann Sarnoff,
movie going is back. You know, that's such a, you know.
Yeah. Ann Sarnoff, of course, is the former head of WB. Their motion picture unit, right? That's just for folks who don't know.
Very illustrious career in television prior to that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. She's great. I can't wait to listen to that episode. That's going to be fun. And of course, the name of your podcast, Don't Kill the Messenger, you can find it on Apple, find it everywhere. It's, again, if you want to understand the internal workings of how the movie business works, it's a wonderful place to start.
And yours isn't chopped liver, Sonny. Yours isn't chopped liver. Your podcast is so, I think, educational and needed and fun to boot. And so I think that, you know, it's a mutual admiration society.
I appreciate that. Let's talk a little bit about the streamers and what they're looking for when you test for them, because I imagine it's somewhat different than for a big, you know, theatrical release. But still, quality is quality. I mean, like, people like what they like. Good movies are good movies. And yet it does feel like the streamers are looking for something a little bit different. And I don't know if it's that thing that you just touched on, which is kind of the narrow casting, the ability to kind of find, you know, smaller audiences with what they're making, or what are the streamers looking for when they sit down with your audiences?
Well, first of all, I've learned a great deal since the streaming disruption about audiences, about testing. One of the things that I really find fascinating is this whole notion of engagement. You know, in theatrical films, we would often say pace. But I've learned something a little bit different in the last few years about that word pace. Length is still length. Length is a feeling word. It feels too long. It feels too short. It feels like it was just the right length, okay? But with pace, I find that clearly it's a way in for me to, and I do a focus group, to mine, like, what could be truncated, fair, okay? But really, it's about, are we keeping audiences engaged in a movie from start to finish? In a streaming situation, it is very important to engage at the start, because you will see within the first 10 minutes of a streamer, some movies where people tune out to the tune of 20%. 20%. Imagine 20% of your audience walking out en masse mm-hmm. of a movie in a theater. First of all, you can ask for your money back, is my understanding. If it's within the first half hour, that's kind of a, it's kind of an understanding. I just don't like it. It's like you haven't eaten the steak yet, you know, so you can still ask for money back. Now, don't quote me on that, because I've heard there was an unwritten rule, but that's what I've heard. But you wouldn't, and I've never seen that in ever have I seen, I've seen it in a test screening, but I've never seen it in the actual world. But not so in streamers. Therefore, you need some kind of cold opening or some kind of engaging mechanism to keep people interested enough to say, okay, we got them past the first hump, whatever that means. And I don't want to dumb it down to a cold opening, because it's not necessarily that, but it is a sense of engagement. You've got to find a way to grab them and hold them. Slow builds often do not work when you have a streaming movie. And there are some wonderful films that people tune out of because mm-hmm. they've lost interest in the first 10 minutes. So that, to me, is a very fascinating thing. Now, let's take that a little further into the body of the movie. Less about pace per se, but more about, are you keeping them engaged? Is there enough incidents? Is there enough character depth? Is there enough to keep people from tuning out, going to the bathroom, going into the kitchen, multitasking, all those things that happen at home? And so the benchmark is higher for engagement, but still in all, I think one could learn from the other. One of the platforms, the modalities, meaning the in-home versus out-of-home experience, can learn from each other about engagement and keeping audiences riveted to these characters, keeping audiences riveted to what's going on next. And then once you understand that, once one understands that, I think the alchemy for success is exponentially greater.
Have you seen, you know, this is something that that I think Ben Affleck and Matt Damon were talking about. They were out there promoting The Rip. And they're talking about working with Netflix, and, you know, they tell us we have to do certain things. We have to, you know, kind of repeat the ideas a couple times in case somebody. And it's interesting. Have you noticed filmmakers or even the streamers themselves adjusting the sort of things that are made, like in the writing stage, even to better accommodate how people are they are watching at home.
Yeah, and by the way, you know, I read that quote, and that's the sort of more crass or humorous way that Matt, I think, painted that. I love those boys. I find them two of the smartest guys that I've worked with. But there's creative ways to do that without overtly announcing the plot again, you know, or the, but there are ways to visual cues and ways to remind us of things, because you don't have as much of an attentive audience. You don't have it. You have to sort of, but that doesn't mean you dumb your stuff down. It just means you may have to check your cadence a little bit differently, right? You may have to not assume a visual cue that is so important to the reveal, let's say, of a plot point. It may also need to be an audio one as well. You know, I mean, that's something that, you know, I don't think Stanley Kubrick before streaming ever took place, would have contemplated, or Orson Welles, or pick your great filmmaker. But that is a reality of how people are consuming movies and television now, at home versus not at home.
Yeah. Again, you have to, you kind of have to go to where the audience is, not the what you hope for. Let me, we're coming.
Sunny, I just want to say yes and no. Yes and no. Meaning you have to understand the audience. It doesn't mean you have to, as I said, dumb it down. But you should understand that it's intuitive sense that if I'm watching this movie at home, my attention's going to be different. I'm not going to lie. There are movies I watch on Turner Classics and so forth, older movies. And I might, at the same time I'm watching them, be working on Scrabble or my Gin Rummy or something like that on my iPad, just because I'm always all over the place and it just kind of focuses me. But I feel like I'm pretty immersed in the movie. Every now and then, I have to say, hey, Neil, would you rewind that? I missed that. Oh, pay attention. Put that effing thing down, you know. But I'm not alone. And let's face it, a lot of us do that. And so, you know, do you cut your movie because of someone like me who's doing that at that moment? No. But you do have to understand that people do that. So there are other things. Oh, I saw a documentary the other night. I was so into it. I threw my pad aside and couldn't take my eyes off the screen. Think about what I just said then, right? One is an old movie from 1935, which was very plodding and very sort of deliberate in its pace. The other one was riveting in its subject matter, kept me completely engaged. I'm just saying, that's what I mean about engagement.
Yeah, it is. I do think there's kind of an interesting medium and message, you know, collision here, right? In streaming, the way streaming works is just very different from the way film works or the way theaters work. Because in theaters, you're theoretically have turned off all of your devices. You're kind of ensconced in this dark room. When you're at home, you're just doing whatever. And that's just the truth. That's how we all live.
That's right. That's exactly right. And so you could either go in the direction the horse is going, or you can try to change that direction. And it's a hell of a lot easier to go the way the horse is going rather than saying, well, I'm not going to do that. Well, you may not, but it might be at your own peril if you want people to really engage and see your movie. But also, it's different kind of engagement. Younger people can engage differently than we can engage. It's just the truth. You know, there's a different kind of way that that the processing works because they grew up as digital natives and we grew up as digital adopters. That's a different kind of sort of brain activity in a way, right? It's a different kind of way to approach storytelling. I mean, how many times have you seen either your kids or your nieces and nephews working on, but they're engaged in the conversation to some degree, right? They're into it and they're talking, and it's just, to me, it's wild. So you have to just understand that, yes, the generationally, things are shifting and changing in that respect, in how we view engagement.
When you're testing stuff both for theaters and for streaming, do you get how do the responses differ from younger audiences? Do you what sort of feedback are you getting from them that you might not get from somebody in an older age cohort?
Well, that's very interesting. It's a very interesting question. I do find that we do see generational differences, particularly with alphas and Zs, the two lowest groups right now in our ecosystem. You're seeing this, again, notion of authenticity, or on the other side of that would be cringe. which is a word that I see more than I would like to see often, mm-hmm. something that just feels fake. It doesn't, mm-hmm. and they're calling bullshit. You know, especially Gen Zs, they're saying, wait a minute, no. And so it just, again, I guess it's a way where you have to measure that against the rest of the audience who may be really enjoying it. Now, it depends if you're making a movie for younger people, mostly, then you want to be very attentive to that kind of authenticity and that cringe and having a voice or voices that if they didn't originally author it, come in and probably do a pass to inject some of that. On the other side of that, you know, there's certain older audiences, the from boomers and, you know, and Gen X, and even some millennials who feel as though, you know, give me back some of my, that traditional stuff that I loved in, you know, the 80s and 90s movies that took me back to my childhoods. And that is its own kind of, alchemy.
Yeah. It's really
generationally. So Sonny, in a nutshell, yeah, I mean, generationally, there's definitely things that cultural cues that are very apparent. And at the end of the day, though, the universal themes, those big universal themes of longing and of desire and of love and of, you know, grief, still hold to any generation. I liken it to cultural differences with ethnicities and races. You know, you can have, you know, there was a whole movement of blaxploitation and nearly every black or African-American person went to that movie. And if you really think it through, there were some of very different economic, socioeconomic mm-hmm. differences, but yet brought together by certain cultural cues. Same with Hispanics. You know, someone from Puerto Rico versus someone from Mexico versus someone from Guatemala versus Haiti or Jamaica are so different, you know, than mm-hmm. each other. But yet there's a certain cultural cue of music, of food, scents, of family. You know, I am I'm Jewish, and my cultural cues are centered around you know, family, the table, the dinner table, the Jewish foods and smells. But I have, as I have religiously probably so little in common with the Orthodox community. It's just, I don't go to shul every day I don't relate to that, but boy, can I smell matzo ball soup and, you know, roasted chicken on a Shabbat dinner, you know, like that's a cultural cue. And so that's interesting to me, and it's very real, those things. That's why advertising often should bring in people who might be specialists in identifying certain cultural cues, because it can add and make something more authentic and make something more more real for that audience and potentially open up that audience.
You mentioned advertising, and I was curious to get your take on how advertising has changed over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years. I mean, obviously we have kind of shifted from TV first, big TV campaign. I mean, TV is obviously still an enormous driver of attention and cost. But there are other, I think, better, more subtle ways of getting to audiences through social media, everything else. How has advertising changed? How has reaching those audiences changed?
Dramatically. I don't agree with what you just said about the tension of television advertising, maybe for certain people, but that would be relegated to sports, let's say, live events.
Sure.
But by and large, a lot of television advertising that would have promoted movies 20 years ago is a complete waste of money. It is still, so I don't get letters from the agencies, it is still a very effective way for large movies to create what we call reach and frequency. It's very hard to do that digitally because of the fragmentation. But if you are trying to create large numbers of people being aware of something repetitively, broadcast is still one of your best bets, but most people can't afford that to lay that foundation. But if you can, it is a really good measurement to do with, as I said, live sport events. I personally have not watched a commercial in, and I don't know how long. We watch programming and we just fast forward. Unless it's something live where we can't fast forward, or and then we might be cooking or something in between, but we're watching certain commercials. And so there's certainly effective in certain areas and for certain audiences, okay? But by and large, digital is a very effective way of reaching people. But Sonny, it's not just digital. That's just a word. It's about engagement again with a community. It's about trusting a source that you feel like you can get behind. And it usually is someone like a family or friend. In all full disclosure, I sit on a board called SGG. And SGG is our series of 2,500 sports micro-influencers. A micro-influencer goes to like 25,000 to say 100,000 people. And this SGG has put together, they almost act as an agent for 2,500 different micro-influencer sites, totaling almost 90 million people. So that is a way to put stimulus in front of, or advertising, you know, in front of all these different people, and have the micro-influencers endorse the product, the movie, the whatever it is, because there's an authenticity there. There's a trust there, and you're going to trust people with whom you interact daily with, who haven't burned you, who don't seem to have an agenda. And that, to me, is the next wave of advertising, which is really very intimate and very trusting with community. Movies should be starting their advertising campaigns well before they shoot a frame of film. Mm-hmm. Have the audiences engaged in the set visits, in the shooting schedule, actors' interviews. From the beginning, you're creating a grassroots, authentic community of people who are going to be with you from the beginning to the end. You know, I admire Angel Studios with their Angel Network, because they have these several hundred thousand people who are who want the same kind of thing. They want something that is going to uplift them, speak to their souls, and they'd rather give this money per month, say, to Angel Studios as opposed to, say, to another streamer, where they feel like they can control the talent. They vote on the angel investors, they vote the angel network, they vote on the content that is going to be made. They then have an option to even invest more money into how to market it. So, and then they get money back. It's just a really excellent way of thinking about community and the use of community to make movies. Different model, yes, but no less effective in many circumstances.
Yeah, the angel model is really interesting. It's a fascinating experiment. The set visits and things you mentioned, I come out of the, or I am familiar with the, kind of big superhero community, sure. Right? We could discuss that. And that was always a big thing with, we've got guys on the set at, Batman versus Superman. We've got guys on the set at Fantastic Four, whatever. Does that translate to the broader mainstream film going world? I'm just curious if normies, for lack of a better word, normal people who aren't deranged like me, if that actually appeals to them, if that's a thing that they're tracking and watching.
Look, it's another good question. I don't think it necessarily does, but it doesn't have to. In other words, you have to look at something as if it's the epicenter, and your fan base is at the epicenter. And from the fan base, it goes out from there. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have the initial, I'm going to call them passionate advocates, if you don't have the initial evangelists, then it's that much harder to get people because they become your network. Now, remember, you're doing all this around it with what traditionally we do with advertising, television, outdoor, all of this. But the grassroots effort is going to be opening up from the inside. So it's almost like you're barraging them with, your fan base, your initial fan base, and then you're coming in on the fringes for all the opportunity segments or opportunistic segments that may be that you don't want to leave behind. But remember, the idea is that in this epicenter, some of those folks are going to touch people who don't participate in it. Because they're going to tell their friends, their parents, their coworkers about what really fascinates them. And that will get people going, oh, I heard about that. Oh, yeah, that. So it's all part of the ecosystem that I think is very, very important now. Because there's just so much noise. You got to find ways to be special. A lot of advertising is just shit thrown at us, and they like what's going to stick, what's not. And, even if you hear something multiple times, doesn't necessarily say it's even sticking. There has to be something. I'd rather have like one great message, one great message that gets me going, ooh, and I can retain that. And that's only going to happen from Sonny Bunch, who I respect, saying to me, oh, Kev, before we go on air, I just want to tell you, I saw blah, blah, blah. I'm going to run to see that movie or that show if you said it, because I have respect mm-hmm. for you. And it would go both ways. If I said, oh, Sonny, I saw this thing, run to see it. There's no way you're not seeing it. You may not see it tomorrow, but you're going to see it. And if you don't see it right away, there's going to be another friend of yours who's going to mention, you go, oh, I really need to see that. That's going to actually push you. All the advertising in the world, if it's not like just grabbing you, and most doesn't, then it's contributing to this noise factor and not something that's going to convince you. And that has to happen with, baking the cake. You can't just expect it to happen. Like it did when there were three networks or four networks, when there was must-see TV Thursday night. That whole construct of must-see TV was because of movie advertising, really, for the weekend. So they had great shows Thursday nights. They could advertise the shit out of them, spend a lot of money on advertising, and people were prepped for the weekend about what was coming out until more choices came out.
Yeah.
And that was less effective,
Yeah. No, it's I just the way the world has changed over the last 20 years, just watching, you know, kind of living through it. It's been fascinating. You know, I could talk to you all day, Kevin, but we're running up against the time here. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked. I mean, there's so many things we didn't discuss from your new book, How to Score in Hollywood. Which folks can pick up on Amazon. It's great. Amazon bookshop.org, wherever you buy books, go check it out. But what did we not discuss that we should have that
I
folks
don't
should
think
know
we
about?
Talked about the Oscars at all.
We haven't talked at all about the Oscars. I have an Oscars question from your book.
We haven't talked about the Academy Awards.
I know. We got to do this. All right. So in your book, in your new book, you talk about two different Oscar, very successful Oscar movies. One of them is Bohemian Rhapsody, mm-hmm. and the other mm-hmm. is Fargo. And these are two very fascinating, fascinatingly different movies for how they tested. One tested very, very well, maybe amongst the best tests ever. Fargo tested less well, but yet both were still huge successes. What should studios take away from that? What's the lesson there?
Well, in the case of Fargo was a movie that was a specialized film. Let's face it, that was not a mainstream movie. That it did sort of creep into the mainstream, but it got unanimous, like sort of great reviews, didn't it? And so as a result of that, people were almost informed that you're not cool if you don't like that movie. Like the critics had a very strong influence on it. In the case of Bohemian Rhapsody, that was an enormous financial success worldwide. And it wasn't just because Queen is so popular. It was because, you know, there were some universal themes. Graham King did an extraordinary job bringing it to life. Rami Malek knocked it out of the park as Freddie Mercury. But, you know, it was fun. So fun. It was elevated. It was this concert footage that they did, and it just, you wanted to just, you know, enjoy it, feel something, and at the same time, leave your brain at the door. And as a result, it was a massive hit. Both successful in their own right, both made for very different amounts of money. There's so many examples of that. And that's, to me, the fascination and why the book, How to Score in Hollywood, I think is so important, particularly for anybody contemplating making a movie. I mean, I don't want to make this feel like it's just a business book, because it's not. It's for really for any entrepreneur that wants to start a product, like just stuff to think about, mainly your audience. And your audience doesn't have to be an audience for entertainment. The audience is an audience for an iPhone, for a Tesla, for furniture. You're starting something. Every business has an audience or audiences that you're required, and shame on you if you don't understand them fully and completely. If you do, you're going to be ahead of the game. And I really do believe that in every sort of ounce of my being.
Let's talk just real quick about this year's Oscars, because we've got, you know, the Oscars are coming up. They're just around the corner here. I have my picks in over at the Ankler. We're watching this closely. I'm curious. Well, I don't want you to talk out of school. I don't know what you can and you can't talk about. I was just looking at the list of Best Picture nominees, yes. And in my head, I was like, you know what? I bet Sinners and I bet F1 tested through the roof. And I don't know necessarily how everything else would have if it was tested. Can you shed any light on how audiences have responded to the Best Picture movies this year? If you can, I don't want you to get in any trouble.
Well, thank you. I can't really talk about specifics, but I can tell you that most of those movies, if not all of them, that tested, there were a couple that didn't test at all, tested very highly, higher than you might have thought, which mm-hmm. supports what I said earlier about audiences wanting something different. a unique and singular voice. They'll appreciate it and reward it. And that's part of what I learned when I made that comment. Like, that is where I picked up on this phenomenon. It was from those scores. So, and not everything started with high scores, but evolved after the process, filmmakers listening to the audience to make things clearer, to make things more truncated, to make endings that perhaps were a little bit more satisfying. That was gratifying to work on many of the Oscar nominees. There are movies like in F1, you can imagine that people have gone on record saying the highest movie I ever worked on. I can confirm that is true. It tested extraordinarily high, but many of them did because people, you know what? People can sense quality. They just can. It's really fascinating to me. Audiences are so much smarter than we think and sophisticated than we think.
Yeah. All right. Well, Kevin Gatz, thank you again for being on the show. I really appreciate it. Again, the name of the book, I want to get it out there again just for folks so they can Google it. How to Score in Hollywood, Secrets to Success in the Movie Business. And it really is, again, this is if you found this interesting, you want to understand why the movies that you see are getting made, how the movies that you see are getting made, this is a key book. You gotta pick it up.
And you need to continue to listen to Sonny Bunch and his marvelous take on the movie business, because he is singular in my mind.
It's very nice of you to say. You know,
I just wanted more airtime.
All right. Kevin, thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you so much.
And again, my name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark. We'll be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.